Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. It's hardly breaking news that banking drives our local economy, but even by those standards, this has been a busy summer. Just in the past 2 weeks, Bank of America reported the company's highest first-half earnings, while Wells Fargo's 20% increase in quarterly profits brought more critiques than kudos. And those are just the secondary stories. Why? Because all eyes, especially in Congress, are on a proposed $66 billion merger between BB&T and SunTrust. The combined company would become the nation's sixth-largest commercial bank and be based in Charlotte. In addition, gains by the likes of LendingTree, AvidXchange, and Stratified recently prompted Fortune magazine to call Charlotte the South's capital of capital. Joining me today to discuss those stories and other money matters is Caroline Hudson, my colleague at the Charlotte Business Journal, who covers banking and finance. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Tony Mesilla, who runs the business newsletter and website The Charlotte Ledger and was formerly with The Charlotte Observer.
Good morning, Eric.
And Paul Davis of American Banker, who is editor of Community Banking and Mergers and Acquisitions. So let's start with that $66 billion proposed merger between BB&T and SunTrust that I just mentioned a moment ago. Last Wednesday, the House Financial Services Committee discussed the deal and heard from SunTrust CEO William Rogers and BB&T CEO Kelly King. Here's what Maxine Waters, the California Democrat who leads the committee, had to say about the merger.
I'm concerned that if this merger goes forward, it will create yet another mega bank that is too big to manage and that poses a risk to our financial system. This is the largest proposed merger since the financial crisis, and it would create the sixth largest bank in the nation. If this merger is approved by regulators, the resulting bank would have around $442 billion in assets, making it larger than Washington Mutual was and more than twice as large as Countrywide was. Of course, the failure of those two institutions played a significant role in the financial crisis. As the Trump administration has rolled back rules for our biggest banks, I and other Democrats warn that we would see larger banks start to merge again, and sure enough, here we are.
Let's begin with how do those concerns affect the possibility of the merger, the likelihood of the merger?
I would say not very much. I would say that there's a long history of politicians wanting to beat up on big banks, and I think that's what you have a manifestation of here. I mean, this would be the biggest bank merger since 2009, since the Great Recession of a decade ago. But, you know, as much as they like to weigh in with a lot of these concerns about the size of banks, I think if you look at what this is expected to do to the deal, I think there's almost no impact, and you can see that in the stocks and what they did on the day of this hearing, that they actually went up. If it was going to cause a problem with this deal, you would expect those stocks to tank. So the fact that the market thinks that this is not that big of a deal, that it's a political posturing, I think that's, it still looks like all signs are go.
You know, there's not a lot of real crazy exotic business dealings at either bank. You know, the things that people worried about in the wake of the financial crisis, there's not a lot of heavy capital markets. There's not a lot of, trading operations, things like that. And honestly, the banks have been pretty proactive in terms of outlining what they're going to do for diversity, outlining their community plan, things like that. I mean, obviously, there's been some critique about the community plan, but they have a community plan. And those are the types of things that tend to move these things along rather than getting them stalled in a legislative process.
So that was Tony Mesilla with the first part of the answer, and then Paul Davis. And Caroline Hudson, you were about to weigh in. Go ahead.
I was. Well, nothing much more to add here. I just wanted to say that I do agree with Tony and Paul here that this isn't really going to affect whether or not the merger will happen. I think the big thing you have to pay attention to is the regulators. Those are really the people who will make or break you as a bank. So this is all, in my mind, I hate to say for show, but for show. it really is. And so not that to discount, the politicians' concerns or questions that they have, but this is really just jumping through hoops, I think.
And I do think, if I could jump in, I do think that it is an opportunity for these politicians to outline some of their concerns and make sure that these banks are involved in communities. I mean, you heard a lot of complaints and concerns about what's going to happen to employment, what's going to happen to some of these smaller communities served by SunTrust and BB&T. So it's a chance, I think, for politicians to get on the record and get the CEOs on the record as making commitments that some of the politicians want to see.
And so while Congresswoman Waters referenced Washington Mutual and Countrywide, which were two of the failures that helped cause the Great Recession or were at least problems during the Great Recession, the ranking Republican on the committee blamed Democrats. I know that's shocking to everyone that Democrats would blame Republicans and Republicans would blame Democrats. Nonetheless, it happened. Patrick McHenry is from North Carolina. He represents the 10th District, which includes Gastonia, Shelby, and Lincolnton. Here's what Patrick McHenry had to say last week.
Now, today, we're examining the potential merger of two institutions that have pointed to the post-Dodd-Frank regulatory landscape and the cost of compliance as one of the drivers behind their decision to merge. I can't help but believe this is another example of buyer's remorse on the part of my Democrat friends. It was Dodd-Frank and the resulting 400 new financial regulations that have forced consolidation in the financial services industry. It is my colleagues on the other side of the aisle that have made the largest banks larger while suffocating smaller institutions.
What I want to ask about his comments are whether those are more reflective of how the industry views what's going on right now.
I would jump in and say that I do feel like at least in the wake of the financial crisis, there was a lot of concern that legislation was causing undue burden, undue headaches. And I think they did look at it pretty much as a reactive move by the part of, a lot of it was, the Democrats when Dodd-Frank came in. But you have to also look at the fact that there's been a lot of relief, a lot of easing of certain things in the last few years as well, particularly for smaller banks. But, I would say more often than not, they pointed to Washington as a hindrance on their business models after the crisis.
Now, Tony mentioned the effort at community outreach by BB&T and SunTrust in part to, I think, allay some of these concerns. The banks had recently announced $60 billion worth of minority outreach and community programs. And I wanted to play this exchange between Alma Adams, who's a Charlotte Democrat, and BB&T's Kelly King, who is the CEO, and they're talking about affordable housing.
I'm still concerned about what your merger will mean to our communities there. Can I get a commitment that you and Truist will dedicate efforts and resources to securing affordable housing for long-term residents? We have a serious problem with housing, and if we can get a commitment past 2022,
Representative, as you may know, I've lived in Charlotte twice, and now we'll be moving there again soon. We recently made substantial commitments, each one of our organizations, to affordable housing in Charlotte.
So is that going to be enough, particularly when you had a hearing where there was reference to SunTrust paying $1 billion 5 years ago because of various mortgage violations, and they both have history, as almost every bank does, with charging minority customers higher fees and interest rates. So what else will they need to do to satisfy those concerns?
Well, it sounds like they're making all the right noises. They're saying all the right things, making all the right commitments. They're not the only banks that are saying that. You have, the other big banks in town here, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, pretty much all the big banks, even the ones not, without a major presence here, have made these sort of commitments to try to smooth things with Congress, to try to smooth things with regulators. I mean, there are federal laws, there are a lot of regulations that require banks to be involved in a lot of these communities, and they want to uphold those commitments.
Again, we are talking banking. My guests are Caroline Hudson, who covers banking at the Charlotte Business Journal, Tony Macia of the Charlotte Ledger, and Paul Davis of American Banker. Let's back up a little bit. This SunTrust BB&T merger will create a new headquarters in Charlotte. If everyone, can expand a little bit on the scope of why this is important and what they will be doing here.
Well, I think things that's going to be important is the fact that it'll be bringing jobs from both Winston and Atlanta to Charlotte. Secondly, the plans to have a technology innovation center certainly that certainly brings a lot of potential as well, particularly with Charlotte's efforts, I'm sure as we might talk later, to be a fintech hub. So, you know, there'll be a lot of investment. There'll be quite a few jobs, I'm sure, and there might even be some benefits to secondary folks as well who, you know, tend to do business with bigger banks as well.
Yeah, I mean, a big feather in the cap, you know, for Charlotte, another, you know, another banking headquarters, another big bank headquartered here, a couple thousand jobs. You know, they're taking over the majority of the Hearst Tower, which is for now called the Hearst Tower, but that, you know, might be renamed. Because
I think they have an option to buy, right? They
I think the building. I believe I read that in a local publication, the Charlotte Business Journal. Yes, I think.
Subscribe now.
Yes.
Sorry.
So, you know, there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of opportunity, you know, for growth there. It's also, you know, it's a feather in the cap, I think, for Charlotte, both in terms of jobs and in terms of, you know, building up this industry, continuing to build this industry in new ways, an industry that's been very important to Charlotte.
And if I might jump in here, I think it'll be interesting to watch, especially the technology hub that they keep touting that they're going to bring to Charlotte, especially as Charlotte continues to get more more fame, I guess you would call it, around technology and, you know, the growing sector here. And, you know, they have been a little bit tight-lipped about what exactly a technology hub means, what they're going to be doing. What's for sure is that they're going to be investing billions of dollars in this. And so I think it'll be interesting, not so much the jobs coming from Winston-Salem in Atlanta, but the future jobs that maybe they can try to create with this hub and building out the corporate headquarters here.
It seems like all the banks are obsessed, and I guess every industry is, but the banks particularly are obsessed with technology and what's next. And I guess they all say it and see it that people aren't using branches or they're using them less and less. And so this is where they have to go.
Right. And, you know, both CEOs of BB&T and SunTrust have said that this was a big driver behind the merger, that investing in technology, they can do more together than they can separate.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a huge trend, I think, and it's not just BB&T and SunTrust, but you're seeing that across the industry, where a lot of these banks are. I mean, you think of banks as, you know, the place you go to get your mortgage, the place you go, you know, to make your checking deposit, but they're really, in many ways, becoming technology companies. They've pretty much said this, you know, in terms of both developing, you know, apps, in terms of customer facing types of applications, as well as the internal stuff that we don't really see. But a lot of these workers now are very tech savvy. They're not just the sort of the button down guys in the ties walking down Tryon Street that you used to see. But you know, they're very, there's a lot of technology in these banks.
Go ahead, Paul.
But it's also going to be a bit of a show me story too, I believe, in that it's great to be able to talk here in 2019 about how you're going to reinvest in technology, in mobile platforms, in apps, et cetera. But we may not know for another 5 years how successful those efforts really are. You know, there's a couple of banks in the Northeast that are doing the same thing. They're doing a merger. They're going to say they're going to funnel cost savings into tech. But right now, the investors in those banks aren't buying it because they really need to see tangible results before they decide whether these strategies actually are going to pay off in better returns.
That was the voice of Paul Davis from American Banker. We also have Caroline Hudson from the Business Journal and Tony Macia from the Charlotte Ledger. This is a Truist story. Sorry, I had to do it. We will be right back. We're going to talk a little bit about the name game with BB&T and SunTrust. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Our topic today is banking and some of the important developments affecting Charlotte of late. Our panel of experts includes Caroline Hudson, who covers banking at the Charlotte Business Journal, Paul Davis, who is an editor at American Banker, focusing on mergers and acquisitions and community banking, and Tony Macia, who is editor and founder of the Charlotte Ledger. So I made that terrible pun at the end of the first segment about Truist, which is the name of the SunTrust BB&T combined company. So they announced that in June. They received plenty of heckles online, but perhaps more worrisome, they also received a lawsuit from Truliant. So how is this likely to play out?
this lawsuit, I mean, it was filed about 6 weeks ago, in which Treliant was saying, listen, you're sort of impinging on our name here. It's going to cause a lot of confusion among customers. There really hasn't been any movement in that lawsuit, no response filed yet by SunTrust and BB&T. I mean, I think ultimately, I'd be curious to hear Caroline and Paul's opinions, but I don't think that this is something that's going to take years to resolve and play out in a messy court case. I think ultimately you see some sort of a settlement, some sort of negotiated truce in which they resolve something on this name. I mean, it's not an uncommon. I mean, there are a lot of banks that have the word trust in their name, Bank and Trust. Is this confusing to people who bank at a bank whose name is Bank and Trust? I don't think so. So I think you would expect to see some sort of a resolution at some point.
So I was going to ask if this ends with someone writing a check, but I don't know if anyone writes a check anymore. Nonetheless. Does it end with someone writing a check?
Some people do, Eric.
Oh,
I'm just saying.
There you go.
maybe they'll Venmo or use Zelle
They'll Venmo the settlement.
That's
yes,
right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, Caroline, Paul, do y'all agree with that? That this will not ultimately end up in court?
I don't know if it'll even end up in a settlement. I mean, obviously, the onus is on Treliant really to really make a strong argument that they're going to get hurt by this or that there's going to be confusion. But the honest truth is, other than say Winston-Salem and Charlotte, these operations for Truist are going to be much larger in scope, and there's not going to be that much overlap. I mean, it could be that, honestly, I'm not even sure the case gets it all that goes through. It could just be dismissed.
And I would agree with both of you. I don't think this would go farther than a settlement for sure. Again, as Paul said, when you're talking about Truist, I mean, just the sheer scope of this bank is so much wider than Treliant is here in North Carolina. So when you look at it, I think, you can see where Treliant is coming from, but at the end of the day, I mean, who's the bigger player here? Mm-hmm. It's going to be Truist.
Maybe it was just a good marketing campaign by Treliant.
Yeah, do you think? I mean, we're talking about it. Everybody, people talk about it a lot. I don't know about you. I've started noticing now you see Treliant on buses and you see him on the branches, and I don't know if I've ever noticed Treliant before.
Treliant, as being here in the Greensboro-Winston market, Treliant is very good at marketing themselves as the alternative to the big, bad, nasty banks. I mean, they're the ones who had a campaign at one point that said, we will not merge with anybody else. You know, hint, hint, we're not a bank. We're not going to, merge and forget about you. I mean, Treliant's been pretty good about it. And to that point, yeah, this could just be another slick way of just getting their name out.
Paul, since you're in the triad, I was going to ask you, there was a story in the Winston-Salem Journal, I think it was Richard Craver wrote it. It was about the social and cultural issues that surfaced during that congressional hearing last week. And the CEOs from the banks heard questions about loans to gun manufacturers and loans to private prison and detention center operators. And I think everyone's been pretty clear that they're not expecting the merger to ultimately be held up. But I am curious what role, if any, those issues are now playing at the banks as they face more scrutiny over those types of issues.
That's a good question. I mean, I think every merger has its own cultural hurdles that the two sides have to get over. I mean, BB&T and SunTrust have claimed over and over and over again that there are no issues, they're in agreement. But sometimes you don't even realize those divides until they name the next layer of management or until the deal closes and you start seeing who stays, who goes, that kind of stuff. I do believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe SunTrust has come out and said that they're no longer going to be involved with the private prison business.
Correct.
That may not have anything to do with BB&T. I mean, almost everybody else who was in that space, including Bank of America, is getting out. So, I will say that Kelly King and the folks at BB&T have been pretty good at handling cultural issues with mergers. I mean, they did an MOE 20 years ago, and they've done several of these. So I think if anybody is going into a deal with eyes wide open in terms of culture, it would be the BB&T folks. Question, I think, is going to be whether the SunTrust guys really fall in line or not.
That was the voice of Paul Davis. He is with American Banker. We also have Tony Mesilla from the Charlotte Ledger and Caroline Hudson from the Charlotte Business Journal. So let's move on to the giants, Bank of America and Wells Fargo. Bank of America for the unbanking initiated, such as myself, is the nation's second largest bank with $2.4 trillion in assets. Wells Fargo has its East Coast hub in Charlotte and is the city's second largest employer with 26,000 jobs and a mere $1.89 trillion in assets. By comparison, BB&T and SunTrust would be around $450 million. That just gives you a little idea of what kind of money we're talking about. So both of these companies, B of A and Wells, had interesting but very different earnings reports this month for the second quarter. What did we learn?
Well, one thing that jumps to mind, especially with Bank of America, they are just continuing a crazy winning streak. I would categorize them as, at least right now, kind of the golden child in the banking sector. Obviously, that was a different story a decade ago, but that's how it is now. So they are posting some of their best earnings in their company's history. I believe it's 18 now consecutive quarters of positive operating leverage, which certainly says a lot considering where they were back in, you know, even 2010. So they have just really turned it around, and you know, I don't see that stopping anytime soon. I mean, as long as the economy continues to drive forward as it is now, although growth is slowing slightly, it is still growing. So I think they're going to continue to deliver on that.
Is the big worry here the likely interest rate cut later this week? Is that the big worry for B of A and everyone else?
That seems to be the big worry, that on Wednesday, the Fed is meeting and is expected to cut interest rates, which squeezes banks a little bit, although I would say squeeze is sort of a relative term in the sense that these banks have had quite a run. I think Bank of America stock, I think, is up 25% on the year. Most major banks are up double digits. Even Wells Fargo, with all its troubles, I think is up 7 or 8% on the year. I think that's...
Did I mention the $2.4 trillion in assets? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes, rounding error. So I think you might see a little bit of a slowdown by the banks, but the good news for banks, and if you have bank stocks, is that these banks still have ways to make money even if the economy slows down. They're so diversified that I wouldn't worry about Brian Moynihan being seen on the streets of Charlotte asking for change.
There's a big difference between, say, a Bank of America and a Wells Fargo and the community banks that, you know, kind of our team focuses on. I mean, community banks are still very much focused on the balance sheet, loans and deposits. They're going to feel it in a much more pronounced manner than, say, a B of A, who can rely on capital markets or just the volume of loans that they do to offset the margin compression.
Let me ask a couple of novice banker questions for those in the audience who, like me, may struggle with some of these terms. Positive operating leverage means what, roughly?
Essentially, just to, you know, put it as simply as possible, it's, you know, when your income is growing faster than your expenses are. So
that's a good thing.
Yes, good absolutely. Thing. You're in the black.
And then the other thing that I think might make some people scratch their heads who don't follow banking closely is with Wells Fargo. They reported profits of $6.2 billion in the second quarter, up 19% from 2018. And yet analysts weren't impressed. Why weren't they impressed?
You know, I've always thought it was interesting, the difference between making money and making the amount of money that people expect you to, or making it in the manner by which you're expected to. So you can make money, as Wells Fargo did, but certainly I think analysts and investors wanted to see them maybe making more progress, particularly in terms of expense cutting. I think they aren't cutting expenses nearly as aggressively as maybe some people thought. But then you also have to take into account that they have an interim CEO, and it's going to be very, very difficult for Wells Fargo to really chart a strategic direction, cut costs, grow revenue, invest, until they actually know who's going to be running the company over the long term.
Now, I am so glad you mentioned that. That is a beautiful segue. The issue of a new CEO. So we had John Stumpf, who resigned in 2016, largely because of the sham accounts. Maybe as many as 3.5 million accounts started by Wells Fargo employees trying to meet sales goals. So John Stumpf has a disastrous session up in Washington. He ends up resigning in 2016. Then Tim Sloan, who was also a veteran executive there, he takes over. And then in March, he announces he's leaving. As of June, he is gone. And now the search for a CEO is, I think, into its fourth month. And one of the names that has surfaced, reported by Bloomberg, was Kathy Bessant. She's an executive here in Charlotte with Bank of America. So why don't we start with, who is Kathy Bessant and what do we think her chances are?
Well, I'll jump in here. Kathy Bessant is Bank of America's Chief Operations and Technology Officer. And so she has played a very large role of the bank, especially here in Charlotte. She's one of those, you know, you think back to the Hugh McCall days. She's one of those pro-Charlotte people who are here and always supporting the community from, you know, the perspective of what the bank can do. Some of the things she's done as well, she's very involved with UNC Charlotte here. She was integral in bringing the NASCAR Hall of Fame to Charlotte. And also a lot of the redevelopment happening in the North Tryon area, which is ongoing, of course. So I think as far as her chances, I would say she has a chance because she's done such great work not only at the bank but also in the community where the bank is, which is, of course, a good look for Wells Fargo, much needed. But also she's a top-notch executive. She's a smart lady, and you could also argue it would help to – it would help Wells Fargo's look to have a woman in that top CEO role. So that's another point to consider.
And maybe help the industry, right? We've never had a female CEO of one of the big banks. Is that correct?
Now is Beth Mooney. Beth Mooney at KeyCorp is probably in a league of her own in terms of female CEOs of even a bank of any kind of size.
Yeah, it's hard. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to just say, just to add on about Kathy Bassan. I mean, she was American Banker's most powerful woman in banking last year. So obviously she's got a lot of national recognition beyond just the Charlotte area. But I wonder if the question is going to be is, would she want the job? I think back, it's not a perfect correlation, but I think back just 10 years ago when Ken Lewis was, retiring, and they went through the search to find his replacement, and all the names were mentioned. It was Al DeMolina, it was Bob Kelly, it was, you name it. Everybody's name came up, but nobody wanted to take the job. And so then the question is, is it hers? Maybe, but does she want the job when she's in a good position already at Bank of America?
Yeah, I was just going to add that it's hard to get visibility into these CEO searches. And this one, I think, is more so than others. You haven't seen a whole lot of leaks that have come out about it. I think Wells Fargo has been pretty explicit in saying it would like to get a woman CEO in that job because, as you mentioned, Eric, when you see these CEOs line up in front of Congress, it's a bunch of old white guys. And so I think they would like to add, see a little bit of diversity there. But, we really haven't seen a lot indicating sort of where this is going. Are they looking for someone who's just a turnaround specialist? Are they looking for someone who has a lot of political visibility? This is a tough job. It's a lot of political pitfalls. Potentially, you're on point answering to politicians, to shareholders. You might not be able to get paid what you think you should get paid because of all the pressure. So it could be a thankless type of job. I mean, one of the most recent leaks that came out, I think it was a Bloomberg story that said, well, maybe they just leave Alan Parker, in this job, the interim CEO. It seems like the political winds from Washington sort of want somebody fresh and somebody new. But it certainly does seem to be dragging on.
When you look back at Bank of America 10 years ago, similar but different situation, right? They had their own scandals, their own issues. They were looking for a new CEO. They do bring in Moynihan, and now 10 years later, look at where Bank of America is. So, I mean, there is certainly a light at the end of the tunnel. There is a redemption story. Assuming that they can find the right person at the right time to do the right job.
That's the voice of Paul Davis. He's with American Banker. Tony Macia from the Charlotte Ledger and Caroline Hudson from the Charlotte Business Journal are also here. We're talking about banking and its impact on Charlotte, which is never small, but it's been particularly active of late. I was going to ask, there were a couple references to what B of A would refer to as the late unpleasantness, which would be a decade ago. I mean, they were the poster child for all that was wrong in the industry. They ended up paying $76 billion in fines over a 10-year period. But somehow, and at the same time, Wells Fargo was really viewed as the stable, moderate, conservative, just take things along in a very community-friendly way. So how did this script get flipped so dramatically?
I think it's just one of those things that happens. You see developments, and as Paul mentioned, it's a redemption story that, time and some work can sort of heal a lot of those wounds, I think, that Bank of America had with Countrywide, new CEO coming in. And now those troubles seem to be for Bank of America in the rearview mirror. Wells Fargo, completely different story. Like you said, they were the gold standard. Their brand was the number one brand. And now if you look at those brand surveys, they're just about at the bottom. And so It doesn't mean that that's forever going to be the future, but they, you know, it's going to take some time and it's going to take some effort.
I want to go back to Kathy Bessant for a moment. If she becomes CEO of Wells Fargo, do you think that she would be based in Charlotte, and would it matter from a local and regional perspective whether she's here or in San Francisco?
I mean, I think it definitely will matter. I'm just, you know, referencing the points I made earlier about how involved she is in the Charlotte community. If she did move to San Francisco, that would be a huge loss from a community impact perspective. But, you know, who knows? Maybe they'll have her based here. You know, Bank of America's Brian Moynihan, he's mostly based out of Boston, even though the company's here in Charlotte. So it could happen. And Wells Fargo does have its largest employment hub here in Charlotte. So, you know, and who knows? Maybe in a few years they'll just hop on over to Charlotte and have another have another corporate headquarters. Who knows?
That's the great hope, right? If you're in Charlotte, if you're
Wells Fargo has maintained a really large presence in Charlotte. You know, when they came in, and again, talk about being the darling, they got that really great deal for Wachovia, and they didn't completely purge. I mean, they still have a pretty significant presence in Charlotte. So it's not a far-fetched idea to think that they could have the CEO still spend a significant amount of time here.
And you know, the thing that Charlotte always has going for it, you know, Charlotte very much likes to say, is that we are much lower cost than a lot of these other cities. That if you're creating jobs in San Francisco or New York, those are high cost markets. Charlotte, you know, as we all know, beautiful place to live. Come on down. You know, it's not
great weather.
Great weather. Unless we could just go on and on. We could do a whole show on that. But you know, if you're talking about creating jobs, it is maybe lower cost than some of those competitors.
And look at the business opportunity. And there's a lot of business opportunity here, obviously, as evidenced by the fact that you've got folks like JPMorgan Chase and U.S. Bancorp, you know, really putting a lot of resources into not just the corporate side, but now on the retail side with branches.
We will pause there, and we'll be back with more on banking and a little bit of fintech here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Today's topic is banking and a resurgence in Charlotte of late in financial services. My guests are Caroline Hudson from the Charlotte Business Journal, Tony Macia, founder of the new Charlotte Ledger newsletter and website, and Paul Davis from American Banker. As I mentioned earlier, the fintech sector has become quite active lately. This is something that Charlotte boosters have wanted for a long time, and it looked like it wasn't going to happen. It kind of stumbled along, and now all of a sudden we see a lot of signs of momentum. Why don't we start out with something very basic? Can one of you define what fintech is and why it's important to the industry now?
Yeah, I can. Oh, sorry. But no, I was just going to simply say it's essentially the blending of technology and finance, finding ways to use technological innovation to either speed up delivery of financial services, make it easier to access financial services. It's a pretty wide-ranging realm that, you know, can go from anywhere from mobile and online to apps. It can go into AI, blockchain, APIs, you name it. I mean, it's a very wide range of industries that are kind of lumped into a single kind of sector.
And so a couple of these companies that are getting a lot of attention right now that are homegrown, one is AvidXchange. So let's start with them. What do they do and how are they growing?
Well, AvidXchange, so again, as you said, they are homegrown from here in Charlotte. They are an automated payments company, which means we talked about earlier, paper checks, getting rid of those paper checks, having
sad
payments more in real time. So they're, you know, definitely not a startup anymore. They were founded, I believe, in 2000. So ever since they got going, they built a big headquarters building out just north of Uptown here in Charlotte, and just announced last week that they're actually going to build a sister building equally as large, about 200,000 square feet. So they are quickly growing from an employee standpoint as well. They employ about 1,000 people from that campus, and you know, there's also room for a third building if they wanted to. So they're quickly becoming their own little campus up there and blazing a trail for that area for sure.
And I think they're going to hire somewhere around 1,200 people over the next 5 years. They obviously got, I think, a $25 million incentive package from state and local government. But what does that kind of thing do, Tony, for the business community beyond just the actual dollars and cents and jobs, but just reputation-wise?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's huge for Charlotte. I mean, traditionally, you've always thought of Charlotte as being, oh, it's the two big banks. It's, you know, First Union and Nations Bank or Bank of America and, you know, Wachovia or whatever. I mean, but now you're really seeing a lot of that diversity, spill out. I mean, in just a number of ways, not just AvidXchange, but, you know, LendingTree, which has been around for a while, which is growing like gangbusters. It really just, I think, adds some diversity to what we have here in the city. And it's good. I think it's really good for Charlotte to have this. And you sort of see it develop as the banking industry has developed. And as we talked about a little earlier, become a little more tech savvy. I mean, I think that's just generally how regions, evolve, is that, you know, you have a main industry, and as that industry changes, it also changes your city. And so I think it's pretty exciting for Charlotte that you have all these newer companies that are springing up, doing things a little differently, adding their own flavor to the city, obviously hiring a lot of millennials, and you see everything going on in South End, all that craziness down there. I think it's really a positive for Charlotte.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, the article I referred to last week from Fortune Magazine that was talking about Charlotte and its growth in banking and fintech. Dan Roselli, who runs one of the, fintech hub, Packard Place, he had a quote in there that there are probably more ex-Bank of America and ex-Wells Fargo people running around Charlotte than there are current ones, talking about all of them starting up companies and helping these companies. You mentioned, Tony, LendingTree. They're another one that is growing and also adding real estate. Mm-hmm. Caroline, I think you may have covered the announcement last week with LendingTree, did you?
The groundbreaking?
That was my colleague, Ashley.
I apologize. But anyway, they're
either way, it's happening.
Yeah, it's happening, and they're going to take, what, about half of an 11-story building in South End? Is that right?
I think that's approximately right. I mean, you know, they're growing and expanding too, moving from Ballantyne to South End. I mean, that's a really interesting sort of Charlotte success story. You know, Doug Lebda starting that company sort of out of his apartment in the late 1990s, watching it grow, get sold to IAC Interactive Corp, a few different ownership things. They've been on a big acquisition spree lately, buying a bunch of these smaller financial websites, offering all kinds of different products. Again, just another example of one of these companies that straddles that line between finance and technology.
What's interesting is, as you mentioned, Tony, for so many years, the banks, the two big banks, dominated, and there were people who said, that's great, but we don't want to just be defined by one industry because of the risks inherent in that. And now the diversity is going into another realm, but it really is still banking focused. So is that a point of strength or a point of weakness?
I think the evolution of it is a point of strength. If you look at the overall employment in the banking and finance sector, I think it's pretty much held steady as a percentage over the last 10 years or so. So, we are adding these jobs in finance and technology, but we're also adding jobs in other areas of our economy as well, in retail and services and warehousing and logistics. I think this might sound a little boosterish, but we're seeing growth in a lot of different sectors. And yes, banks get a lot of the attention, and yes, these fintech companies get a lot of the attention, but there are a lot of other positive stories, I think, going on with Charlotte's economy as well. So I certainly think it's better than the alternative, which is, these companies leaving, these companies going somewhere else, people making decisions about what goes on in Charlotte in other cities. We're really seeing a lot of that here, and I think it's really a positive, and we would rather have that than the opposite.
And I think you can also just look at the fact that, okay, so we were and still are in many ways a huge banking center, but at the same time, the U.S. economy, global economy is more and more shifting towards that tech sector. Mm-hmm. The obvious answer for Charlotte and the easy answer would be fintech. Mm-hmm. Why not blend them both? That's mm-hmm. a great way to get into that tech sector. I think the thing to watch now is what they continue to do with that. It can certainly be a strength right now, and I think it is for our city. But as far as are you going to continue to diversify your economy within that tech sector, that's the question that we're still watching.
And, the other point I think that's important to make, Eric, is that, you have the big banks are tend to be growing so much. I mean, you look at Bank of America, it's now a global bank. It used to be Hugh McCall growing the bank here, very focused on Charlotte. You know, you wanted something done in Charlotte, you know, he'd call up, First Union, the deal would get
right.
done. Now, I mean, the focus now of a lot of these big banks is not so much in Charlotte. Bank of America, global bank, doing international deals. But so you have a lot of these fintech companies now that I think that are a lot more invested here, maybe than some of those big banks were in the olden days.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. Mike Prager, who is the CEO of Avid Exchange, is more of a focal point around town. You mentioned Doug Lebda, who is the CEO of LendingTree. He is one of the lead organizers in the Republican National Convention next year. And I was going to ask you, Caroline, with Avid Exchange in particular, Mike Prager just made a very interesting hire over there with their first director of, is it corporate social responsibility? I hope I have that title right.
Corporate social responsibility. Yes, no, you're correct. So Avid Exchange recently hired Rob Focus, and he was the former director of sustainability for the city of Charlotte. He was involved in, you know, many initiatives with the city that people might recognize, anywhere from, let's say, electrical vehicle charging stations to renewable energy, Charlotte's Smart Cities Initiative, which also relates to the development happening out at Camp North End. Rob just became a huge name in the city of Charlotte. And the fact that, you know, now he's shifting over to Avid Exchange, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what flavor he brings to the company and some of the things he can do. And, you know, I think it speaks to the growth of Avid as a company, because the larger you get, the more you have to think about these community impact initiatives. That's just the way it goes.
And I was going to say, I think Avid is one of our, we have three unicorns in Charlotte.
That's correct.
I'm not
yes.
talking astrology. So tell everyone what a unicorn is and why that matters.
Unicorns, that is when a company is valuated at more than $1 billion. And yes, you are correct. Avid Exchange is one of three here in Charlotte.
And the other two, do you know the other two off the top of your head? I know Trisada, I think, is one of them.
Trisada is the most recent one. Also, Red Ventures.
Oh, yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Red Ventures.
We're counting them as a Charlotte company, I think, even though their headquarters is across the border.
That's right. That's right.
Still that region.
We can be regional when we want to be, right? for bragging purposes.
We can claim it.
several of those that we just went through on the fintech side, as I mentioned, also are having real estate ripples. But then when you look at the industry as a whole, you really see changes in the skyline. I wanted to hear a little bit about Ally, because this is an interesting bank. They were created from the remnants of the old General Motors Credit Finance Group. Their headquarters are in Detroit, but it seems like they are really investing in Charlotte. So whoever wants to take a stab at Ally and their growth here, the floor is yours.
I guess I can jump in here. Certainly they are investing a lot in Charlotte. You can just look at the skyline, as you said, Eric, with the Ally Charlotte Center. And, you know, just the whole idea of Ally has employees, you know, scattered all throughout the Charlotte region. The idea of bringing everyone here into one building in Uptown, and while also, you know, adding something to our skyline, I think that says a lot. And obviously, they already have a building here on Church Street, but just the fact that they are building from the ground up, making it their own, I think says a lot about where they want to take the company. And, you know, also you have to consider there's some big executives from Ally that are based here. Obviously, you have Jeffrey Brown, the CEO. Again, another CEO who doesn't actually live where the company's headquartered. Also, Diane Marais.
In that case, we like it, though, right?
Yes. Yeah, and that's okay. It works in our favor.
It's also a little bit of a twist on what you think of as a bank. I mean, Ally doesn't have branches. So it's one of these sort of mm-hmm. online banks. And so, you know, it's another, I think, example of that diversity of types of banks that you have growing here in Charlotte.
Also, I just want to jump in here real quick. Think about what a redemption story. I mean, Ally's history was, you know, back, you know, intertwined with General Motors and
bailouts,
yes, federal bailouts, bankruptcy in their mortgage sector. And now look, they're one of the most recognized brands and growing in the U.S. And so I think you want to talk about earlier, you know, with Wells Fargo, redemption story. Look, this happened in a matter of 10 years.
I was going to ask about some of the other real estate projects you have. Bank of America is going to anchor a 33-story tower that is near actually the Ally project that you just mentioned. You have FMB will be the anchor of a 29-story tower that is near BB&T Ballpark, which I assume will be Truist Ballpark at some point. With all the changes in the industry and all the fintech, it doesn't seem as though these companies are seeing any need to shed real estate, at least not in Charlotte.
Just a quick comment that maybe some of that is that even though, you know, the jobs are changing, right? So they need the space, but maybe it's for different jobs, whereas it used to be a lot of retail kind of folks, behind the scenes kind of folks. Maybe it's more the tech stuff, more the innovation stuff, and that's where you need more space now than, you know, whereas, you know, the jobs are just the descriptions are changing even, and the space is still needed.
So in terms of, we've gone through mostly good news here this morning. What are some of the challenges out there, not just for the industry, but for Charlotte as a financial hub?
Well, I would say, again, just thinking about the diversification of the market, making sure that we don't go back to just that financial center, because, you know, we all saw what happened in the Great Recession when that did falter and what an impact it had on the community, not here but everywhere. So you definitely have to think about the diversification. Also, just from a logistics standpoint, all these people moving in for the new jobs, you know, literally thousands of people. I think what they say, roughly 100 people move to Charlotte every day. Yeah, that's crazy to think about.
Yeah, look out.
Right. Right. So just the logistics of, okay, let's take a look at our transit, our transportation. Let's take a look at our roads. This influx of people, how are we going to do it? And how are we going to get these people to these jobs?
Yeah, I think that's a great point that Caroline made. I mean, I think it's an open question how they're going to hire for all these jobs. You have all these massive announcements of expansions, and I think it is a fair question to say, where are all these people coming from? Are they all coming from somewhere else? Are they just poaching from each other? You hear a lot about pipelines, and ecosystems. Those are the two hot metaphors when you're talking about some of these jobs. But yeah, I think it does create some good questions about where are these people coming from. Are their costs going to go up to try to get some of these workers where they need to be? And then, you know, sort of the ongoing Charlotte question is affordability. Is it possible to find affordable housing close in? If you're working at Avid Exchange or if you're working at Lending Tree, where do those people live? Do they have to get an apartment out in Union County and then drive in on Independence in the morning? There are a lot of questions. I mean, it's a persistent Charlotte question. It's the question of growth. Eric, we've been here for a long time, and you know that's one of the major dominant questions of Charlotte is growth, and how do we address that growth, and how do we keep it from getting too out of control?
Which will fill a number of future shows. So the last word goes to Tony Macia from the Charlotte Ledger. I'd also like to thank Paul Davis with American Banker and Caroline Hudson from the Charlotte Business Journal. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.